This is Miff Warhurst on ABC Radio.
Tyson Yunkaporta has written a great book that is an introduction to the world of dreaming and Indigenous knowledge. It's called Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. And his research covers things like oral histories of natural disasters, language, health, cognition, all sorts of things. Welcome to you, Tyson.
Hey.
Nice to meet you and talk to you about this beautiful book, which it kind of blew my mind a little bit. There's a lot of concepts in there that I think could be very helpful and very useful in navigating our current age. And it's probably a pretty timely read. But straight into the title, what is Sand Talk?
Sand Talk itself. Yeah. Well, it's an Indigenous modality, I guess, is one word.
Yep.
But it's a way of transmitting knowledge non-verbally, or that goes alongside spoken words, you know, drawing messages in the sand, symbols, maps of country, things like this.
Yeah.
That, you know, communicate just terabytes of information. You know, I guess a picture's worth 1,000 words, so you can do several thousand words in a few minutes.
And the significance of stories drawn in the sand, are these important stories that are shared?
Yeah, but they might just be, you know, something that just comes into your head as well. It might just be a concept that you're trying to get across, you know. Yeah, well, this was once sort of daily practice in communication between people. So that's that part of the title. Then there's the other part.
Yeah, tell us about the other part.
The cheeky part. I mean, it's really cheeky, you know. How Indigenous thinking could save the world, you know, but I think a lot of the book is cheeky. Because I'm a cheeky fella.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Tell me how it's cheeky. Tell me what you were trying to do. Well, I love that.
Yeah. Basically, I'm a very marginal person in my own community and in the mainstream community as well. But, you know, particularly in my own community, I'm a younger sibling, so I can't speak for country or, you know, be speaking about the big story and big knowledge and all that sort of thing. That's for older siblings who are called Mantain.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm from the I belong to the Uplitch clan on Western Cape York, and you know, I've got older siblings there who speak for all that knowledge, and I'm connected to a lot of other groups around Australia, and you see, you know, conversations with a lot of those people. There's a lot of yarns in this book. It's built on yarns. There's lots of different people, and most of those people are really marginal people as well, because I think there's value to be found in those marginal points of view. You know, that's where you get all your disruptive innovations and out-of-the-box ideas. So it's a series of thought experiments and provocations. It sort of turns the lens around. And I'm not really reporting on Indigenous knowledge for a global perspective. It's around the other way. I'm looking at global systems from an Indigenous perspective.
Tell me the significance of that. I couldn't quite get my head around that idea, and it came alive in the book. But initially, I was like, "What do you mean?"
Yeah, what do you mean? Well, it's a hard one for people to get their head around because, you know, for so long it's just been the world looking at us.
Mm.
You know, our things just hanging on the wall or in a glass box, or talking to us, and always it's just people want to know, you know. Tell us your horrific story of your history, or, you know, tell us about growing up on the riverbank. And it's always this sort of biography and self-narrative and, you know, that kind of experience. Yeah, so it's always this sort of, you know, the outsiders sort of looking in. It's always the, you know, the settler gaze on our bodies and minds and work. But we seldom report on what we see when we look back, you know, because we are looking back.
Yeah. So what do you see when you look back?
Everything. A lot of complexity. But it's just that interaction is so one way so often that, you know, there aren't a lot of opportunities for really productive dialogue. And I guess that's what I'm trying to get going. Yeah, some productive dialogue.
Tyson Yunkaporta is with me. He's the author of this book, Sand Talk, that we're discussing how Indigenous thinking can save the world. Indigenous thinking as a term is a really interesting one. You've mentioned things like Indigenous pattern thinking. What is it and why is it important to know?
Well, I mean, you know, we throw these terms around like sustainability and holistic is another one. You know, there are a lot of words going around, but no one really knows what they mean. People use them as buzzwords and claim that they're doing that, but they're not really. And I guess Indigenous pattern thinking is truly holistic cognition, holistic thought. Basically, that you focus on the context, so you're not zeroing in on one variable and studying it exclusively out of its context. You know, that's useful, a useful way of thinking for a lot of projects, but I think for the project of, you know, stopping everything in the world from dying, you probably need to use a bit more contextual thinking. So, you know, I know there are a lot of studies in cognition that show this, so we tend to, you know, pay more attention to the directions and the spatial awareness, you know, in how we arrange, you know, memorized objects, things like that. Also, when we're looking at a picture, we're sort of attending to the things in the background first and the context rather than just the foreground images, which people from, a low-context culture, you know, like a lot of Western cultures and industrialized cultures tend to just focus on the images in the foreground.
So explain that low-context culture.
A low-context culture is one that it uses that reductionist kind of analytical thought. You know, it focuses on objects in isolation and concepts in isolation rather than the complex world that those things are attached to.
Can you give us an example of that just to illustrate that for the listeners?
Wow, there are so many examples.
Yeah.
But I guess one example in the book is looking at fish oil. You know, so in a lot of this sort of natural medicines that are promoted, there aren't really rigorous scientific studies to back them up, and fish oil is one of them because there's really variable results in the fish oil studies. So in one kidney trial, it'll show that it improves kidney health dramatically, but then in the next, the results aren't replicable because they're just looking at fish oil. But they're only looking at the fish oil as, you know, one substance that can be extracted. They're not looking at seasons, which from an Indigenous perspective you would, because when you harvest that salmon oil is very important. It only has medicinal properties in the right season. And that's not at exactly the same time every year. It's variable. It's when you see those yellow flowers, you know, the wattle flowers, then you know that oil is medicinal.
And that's about looking at the whole picture again.
Yeah. So, you know, you've got a lot of scientific study that just focuses on an isolated variable, like, well, that's a substance, so it'll always be the same. But, you know, in Indigenous sort of concepts of time and space, which are a lot more holistic and complex, you know, we know that that's only medicine, you know, for a couple of months at a certain time.
Right. Know? Yeah. Tyson, Indigenous thinking could save the world, can save the world. That's the title of the book. Can you give us some more examples? That was such a brilliant one. I guess that's an environmental example. What about in terms of, say, things like lawmaking and punishment, which you bring up in the book? I think this was a really interesting point.
Oh, yes. So it's, I mean, I guess, you know, we tell a lot of dreaming stories and we see those, you know, those stones in the landscape that mark those stories on song lines and all that sort of thing. And these are usually stories about crimes and punishments. But I think there's a lot that you can learn from that rather than just, oh, this is a nice story to tell the kids. There's a lot of, you know, things that we can take from that, so with the justice system and things like that. So, for example, you'll see in those stories that, you know, when you break the law in Aboriginal society, you're only a criminal until you're punished for it. You don't carry that sentence, you don't carry that record around with you for the rest of your life. You know, once you've accepted the punishment and you've learned from it and transformed and taken that opportunity to transform yourself, you're free, you know, and you can be respected again. So you've got all these entities in the landscape that have been punished, you know, by being turned to stone. And but they're actually revered ancestors who are known for, like, keeping the law, you know, for all eternity. And I, you know, I think this could be applied sort of productively, I think, for, you know, the criminal justice system, things like this. There's a lot of different ideas that, you know, it's not, and it's not big secret knowledge or anything, but it's just a shift in the way we look at, you know, even the most basic cultural ideas and protocols and values that can be applied more generally. And
well, yeah, the term kinship comes up a lot in the book, conversations and kinship, and I think that's something that we can all take ideas from in terms of how important kinship is in culture.
Well, it's just that relationality, and it comes back to that complexity of thinking, of seeing everything in the universe being in relation, you know, and you're part of that. You're not an objective observer sort of floating above it and observing the field. You're part of a field. You're part of a system that's observing itself. You're not standing outside and observing it. So that relationality is really important. And, you know, particularly the way we relate to each other as well as other non-human entities that we regard as sentient, you know, which helps us have respect for things.
Yeah, it was interesting you speak about rocks. Rocks as having some power, and that's something I'd not really thought about. Power and history and stories.
Yeah, well, rocks are living things.
Yeah.
You know,
we haven't been brought up like that to think about it at all.
Looking up at the sky and going, are we alone? Are we alone?
And yet it was actually, it's the stuff we don't think about is the stuff we probably need to think about the most. And that was a wonderful example of how these ideas environmentally can change how you look at the place. I mean, your example of using the black holes in space, the nothingness, is actually something that is providing us with all the information.
Yeah. And, you know, even the concept of dark matter, which, you know, has recently been found to make up most of the matter in the universe. It sort of changes the perceptions of what's up there. And, you know, for us, that's always been a part of our lore, that dark matter's been in it. It's seen as solid matter up there and solid country, you know, just from, you know, observed, you know, effects in the sky over millennia. Yeah.
Tyson, it's a great book. I've had lots to think about. And like I said, when I was off here, I probably need to read it again to take it all in. But it's some really great ideas in there and things to think about. So,
well, it's all about the conversations. The knowledge isn't stored in there forever. It's just about what gets provoked and what yarns you have and what kind of, you know, relationships you build from that.
The book is called Sand Talk, How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World, and Tyson will be touring about the place, Melbourne Writers Festival, talking with Bruce Pascoe on Friday, September 6th. He's had some brilliant ideas as well, so the two of you will be, no doubt, wonderful in conversation.